Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. LeBron James, Archie Griffin, Jesse Owens each became a legend in his own time for his exploits on the court, the gridiron, and the track, respectively. But Ohio's place in the history of American sports runs so much deeper across gender and racial lines, especially. A point driven home by the Ohio History Center's wide-ranging new exhibit about sports and Ohio. Eric Feingold helped curate the exhibit. He joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Also joining us, Ohio History Connection Director of Cultural Resources, Megan Wood. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you.
Megan, how did you decide the scope of this? Because this is a big one.
Yeah, we started to talk about doing a different kind of exhibit at the Ohio History Center. And based on some research we did and just what we know also being Ohioans is that sports was really going to speak to a lot of stories. And as we started working on this exhibit, we decided to break things up into different themes instead of it being like football, baseball, basketball. And so that's why you see things like victory, adversity, identity, tradition, character and innovation driving this exhibit.
Yeah, innovation has some particularly interesting stories. And so did you like that as a curator that they didn't make it sport related, but it was more these larger themes?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to approach the larger subject of sports. For one, you know, sports are just a great entry point into exploring the human condition, which I think we do through these different thematic zones. But I also hope that by not organizing the exhibit by sport, for example, we can appeal to folks who may not be self-described sports fans as well.
And it also avoids the risk of having people just go to the football section, that kind of a thing, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And it's a big exhibit. How did you decide what size, how big it could be?
We would have loved to make it bigger, which I think is always the case with any exhibit. And we decided to use our space a little differently. So when you come, if you're familiar with the Ohio History Center, and if you haven't been there since the fourth grade, we've changed, so please come. It weaves around the museum a little bit. So you get little pieces of it, too, little call-outs. Even in the stairwell, there's some fun stuff in the elevator. So we really tried to weave sports all around with these main areas. So our first, second, and third floors are filled with it.
Eric, how do you summarize the role of Ohio in the history of sports? What drove you? What was your larger arc?
So for me as a curator, I'm really in charge of working with the objects and the collections that will fuel the stories that ultimately hit on that larger theme that you're talking about. But I feel like the objects and the collections, whether it's from our collection or from other organizations, they can really present some unique angles to the story of sports in Ohio and ultimately to sports in our country. So, I feel like these objects provide some new information that folks may not be able to get from, say, a book. As we've talked about, sports is a really popular subject, and I'm sure a lot of our visitors are going to be bringing their own pre-existing knowledge. So I hope that we can maybe surprise them with a few objects.
What surprised you?
Some of the stories really jumped out at me. For example, in the Innovation Zone, we feature some cycling mirrors that were made by a man named Chuck Harris. And for about 40 years or so, Chuck handmade over 88,000 rear-view cycling mirrors from his home in Knox County. And now that piece of equipment is almost ubiquitous when you're riding a bike or see cycling groups. And it's really interesting to see how one person in Knox County in Ohio really kind of spurred the creation of these pieces.
He made it normal.
Yeah, yeah. He definitely introduced them. And, when you look into cycling communities and cycling groups, for example, on the internet, it's really nice and touching to see some of the recollections folks have. I was going on a cross-country bike trip and Chuck's mirrors saved my life. I was riding and saw a truck coming up behind me, or just little anecdotes like that that really speak to the contributions of Ohio and Ohioans to the national culture of sports.
Which is exactly what we're talking about this hour. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You just heard from Eric Feingold. He helped curate the Ohio History Center's brand new wide-ranging exhibit about sports in Ohio. Also with us, Megan Woods. She's Ohio History Connection Director of Cultural Resources. What do you think it is about the culture of Ohio, Megan and Eric, that make it so prominent on so many different levels when it comes to sports?
We like to think that Ohio is a great mirror of the national and the world story in all ways. We often have these conversations about, like, what is the Ohio identity? And part of it is it's very almost stereotypically American. And so I think what you see in the Ohio sports story, again, is Ohio being the heart of it all. You know, we're a swing state, and how, you know, so goes Ohio, goes the nation. I think you see that in sports, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to jump off what Megan was saying, I mean, if you can go down the line, whether you're talking about professional football or professional baseball, you know, Major League Soccer, Soapbox Derby, there's so many of these larger organized sports that really have strong Ohio roots. So
what's the Soapbox Derby route?
So the Soapbox Derby it's an event held every year where kids will design and build their own gravity-powered vehicles that will race up in Akron at a large arena known as Derby Downs that was built in the late 1930s as part of the Works Progress Administration's work during the Depression. And the first organized derby was held in 1934 in Dayton, and in 1935 it was moved to Akron, and then in 1936 Derby Downs started hosting this event. So you have kids from not just across the country, but across the world that are participating and designing their own vehicles. And
these are the little balsa wood ones. Or are you talking about the ones where they're in they steer it?
Yeah, they're okay. In there. They're steering it.
Gotcha.
The course at Derby Downs is a little less than 1,000 feet. And it's just amazing to see how, you know, these 10, 11, 12-year-olds, you know, dig deep for that innovative spirit and ultimately race these vehicles. It's a pretty neat story. So,
yeah, there's a great jersey in the exhibit from the Soapbox Derby, and it, you know, it's a kid size and it's like a mini sort of NASCAR. it's just great to see across age.
How many sports are represented in the exhibit?
We, by our count, we have about 26 sports in the exhibit. Everything from the four so-called major sports being basketball, football, hockey, and baseball, to soapbox derby, to lacrosse, to roller derby. So we're really exploring sports at many levels, and many types of sports.
You know, Megan, I don't know if I asked you, what surprised you when you heard some of the stories?
I think one of the stories that was really interesting is when we did an oral history with Jesse Owens' daughters, and they were talking about him as a person. We're used to thinking about him as a sports figure. And so those are really touching. You know, there's the story that we know that we're used to hearing about, but to hear his daughters talk about him as an individual was really the touching human story.
In getting those kinds of interviews, what was it like gathering the objects for an exhibit like this, Eric Feingold?
So it's kind of interesting because in a, you know, more traditional exhibit, you'll kind of start with the objects that will drive the content of the exhibit and the overall message. Where in this case, we kind of flipped the script a little bit and put the athletes and coaches and fans, et cetera, in the driver's seat, so to speak. So you would kind of be following along with the oral histories or meeting with the participants and just having a conversation about what objects were important to them, what objects they felt could help tell their story best. So that was really kind of how we approached the object collecting for this.
The exhibit's going to last a long time. It's going to be there at least until, I think, September 2020, did I read, or longer. Is that typical for the Ohio History Connection?
We've had exhibits that are much shorter, that are not a permanent or long-term display, but I think with the amount of vet investment, and then we're also hoping to, as we go through the seasons, to make some changes. We're going to have programs. We do a first Friday film series, and coming up, we're going to be doing Field of Dreams. So we have a lot of opportunity with this topic to dig in deeper as the seasons go by.
Did anything get left on the cutting room floor, Eric, that pains you? If anything didn't, I would be surprised. So
yeah, I mean, the topic of Ohio sports is kind of a blessing and a curse, because, you know, it's a blessing. There's no shortage of stories to feature or choose from, but, you know, we can't fit everything into the exhibit.
Mm-hmm.
So just in the first few days that it's been open, I've had guests come up to me and ask, you know, why haven't you explored Jerry Lucas or, you know, gone into more detail about Jack Nicklaus, and we'd certainly love to.
He's got a whole museum devoted to him.
Sure, yeah. So as much as we'd love to dig deeper into these stories, we just can't, but I hope that that's something that visitors will take away. You know, when they come to the exhibit, they'll get to see these amazing oral histories and objects and learn about these figures and other contributors to Ohio sports, but I hope that they'll be inspired to continue their own research, however formal or informal that may be, once they leave the museum.
We don't see it as a downfall. Someone is saying, what about this? Or you didn't talk enough about the big red machine, or where is swimming? Those conversations that visitors are having in the gallery with each other, that's part of the experience, too. We don't have to be everything. And that's the beauty of our jobs, I think.
Wait a minute. Where is swimming? There is no swimming? Did you forget swimming?
We did not have an opportunity to share swimming, Anne, but we'd certainly be interested in collecting items related to swimming.
And
so
we just couldn't get the swimming pool worked out.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, maybe
it
by September.
Water. Yeah.
Right. You know, it just the whole water system didn't work quite out, the filtration.
Well, that's kind of what it is. I mean, something you can't do at all, and it is a big state. I'm trying to think about how you organized it by those larger themes, and how did that manifest? Can you give me an example? Like innovation, you were talking, I guess, about the rearview mirror on the bicycles would be an innovation story, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And Soapbox Derby is also in there, kind of touching on that point I mentioned earlier about the innovation that's required of the kids who are building and racing the cars. So that was also part of it.
Okay.
And as you walk into the exhibit, the zones have different colors. So you'll see when you walk in and you see Victory and you see a great image of Buster Douglas. And there's some great text that talks about how sports are victory. But then in opposition to that is you have adversity, and you see this amazing picture of Stephanie Hightower with her head down against a railing. So there's some really strong imagery and, you know, people that you will know or maybe not know that are tied to each of those zones.
Have you heard back from the likes of Stephanie Hightower, people who are depicted?
Yeah, so the reception from the folks who were featuring in the exhibit has been very, very positive. It, you know, Katie Smith has given some feedback. And,
oh, is she a basketball player?
Yeah. Yep. So, it's great when, you know, you enjoy the work that you do and the public enjoys it. But really, when you're focusing on certain people in the exhibit as well and they find it meaningful, that means so much. So,
well, I can't wait to see it. Thank you for joining us today to talk about it. We're going to continue our conversation. That is Megan Wood. She's Ohio History Connection Director of Cultural Resources, and also Eric Feingold. He helped curate the Ohio History Center's wide-ranging new exhibit about sports and Ohio. You can learn more about the Ohio Champion of Sports exhibit at the Ohio History Center through Labor Day 2020. Go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And you can also go there to get a link to an event tonight. I'm moderating a discussion about the importance of sports to our culture with Dr. Pete Edwards, co-owner of the Columbus Crew, and Gene Smith, the Ohio State University's Director of Athletics. Again, and go to our website for that link at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Ohio's role in the history of American sports is long and deep. Many of the stories, many familiar and many not so many, are told through a new wide-ranging exhibit at the Ohio History Center. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us to continue the conversation about the role of Ohio in the history of American sports is former longtime Dispatch sports reporter and columnist and now Ohio State Alumni Magazine sports writer Todd Jones. Welcome.
Thanks, Ann. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
What do you think about an exhibit like this, and the idea of the sports and the role of Ohio in the history of sports?
Well, I think it's great. I think it really tells a great story. I had the fortune of going over to see the exhibit before it opened on March 16th, and it's fantastic. I really recommend that people check it out. I think sports means so much to people in our state and in the various big cities and small communities that that I think when you go there, you'll feel a real sense of pride as a person from Ohio. And I think it's just part of people's lives in our state.
Wouldn't any longtime sports reporter, and you've traveled all over the world covering sports for the Dispatch. You've been to at least a couple Olympics, haven't you?
Doesn't
everybody say that about where they come from?
Yeah, I think so. I think what's different about Ohio is that, a lot of times, the East Coast, the West Coast, they're getting all the attention, right? But when you go back and you look at our state and you go back and you look at the history of what came through in sports, Ohio could put itself up there with any state in terms of its impact, influence, the athletes, the coaches. And I think sometimes it's a great way for our state in the realm of sports to get an identity that's national. I mean, people start connecting dots in sports in Ohio, and I think it is more special. A lot of times you'll have different parts of the country that are tied to a certain sport, and obviously football is huge in Ohio, but we have so many different athletes and coaches in all sports that go on to success that I think we have a little more of a national tie and not just one sport.
Mitchie Collette is the coach, co-owner, and co-founder of the Toledo Rain football team. She also played 7 years for the now-defunct Toledo Troopers, which was recognized by the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton as the winningest team in professional football history. Mitchie Collette joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, thank you.
The winningest team in professional football history. The Pro Football Hall of Fame does not say that lightly, right?
Correct. It was quite an honor. I think it was back in July of 1983 is when they put us out there.
Tell us about women's pro football and what kind of stake the Ohio has in it.
Well, currently Ohio has Toledo, Columbus, Cincinnati, and Cleveland as far as women's football teams, and they've been around for a while. Toledo has had probably the longest stint in having a team because Toledo is the original home of women's football way back in 1930. Then the other original team that came in 1971 was Cleveland. So Toledo and Cleveland was probably the, if you really want to technically count numbers, I would say Toledo and Cleveland was the original two teams of women's football that when it started.
What happened that started it in Toledo in the 30s?
Some guy in Toledo had this idea of having two women's teams going against each other and wondered how society would take that. So he created these two teams. Could it be East versus West or North versus South, whatever it was in Toledo. But he made these two teams up and advertised all over for an exhibition game and to see what, how it would stick. And so we had the exhibition game, and the man ended up making hand over fist money with that. And he kind of liked it. So he took his two little teams out of a little small town of Toledo and went all over the Midwest up until about 1931, when First Lady Mrs. Hoover got wind of it, that there was going to be a exhibition game in the University of Detroit. She didn't have a very good thought of it and wrote the man a very scathing letter stating, stop exploiting women, and you're no longer going to have women play football. That's it, no more. So it stopped in 1931. A talent scout named Sid Friedman out of Cleveland got wind of this in the 60s, and he touched with it a little bit, but it didn't go so far. So what happened in 1971, he got in touch with someone in Toledo, and he got in touch with someone in Cleveland, and that's where we began, was Cleveland and Toledo. And what he wanted was to do what that gentleman did back in 1930s, have an exhibition game and see what goes on. So he ended up having Toledo come to Cleveland and had that exhibition game. And Toledo lost that exhibition game. But with the fanfare that this gentleman had, he ended up actually making a league, as you will, mm-hmm. out of Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Detroit, Toledo. And Toledo ended up playing more games and this, that, and the other. My first game was in 1973. We played four games, and all four was against Detroit for some reason. and but see, after that exhibition game in 1971, Toledo went on to win every game up until 1976, when we went to Oklahoma City for the very first time, and we lost at Oklahoma City, which was devastating to everyone, because Toledo Troopers, it was like they never lost. Mm-hmm. And so because of our win-loss record and Oklahoma's win-loss record, we ended up playing the championship in Toledo at the university. It was, I'll never forget that game. It was like 19 degrees out. It was December 11th in 1976. Mm-hmm. There was snow on all sides of the field. It was just so cold. And I mean, it was a grueling game. Toledo was very well matched with Oklahoma City. And I mean, it was like playing against ourselves. They were very, very good. We won that game, and you're talking to the person that was a linebacker and watched this infamous kick, point after kick, that didn't make it. Oklahoma City swears up and down they did. I swear up
to
and
this
down
day.
They didn't. To this day, I say that they didn't, because I remember looking at the kick. I was an outside linebacker, and I remember seeing the kick going up over the uprights, but it was just outside. But see, the official that's right underneath the upright saw the same thing I did. Excuse me. And he called it was out. And yeah. So in about 3 months of arguing, our owners and their owners arguing for 3 months, they ended up calling it a tie. But call it what you will, guys, we won.
You know, Todd Jones, Women in Sports, we're always hearing that they can't generate the same kind of revenue. There's the big lawsuit pending right now with the Major League Soccer women saying that they're not getting a fair shake on all of that. It sounds like it's not what keeps women out of sports, but it does affect the how much we really hear about them.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's kind of how it's decided, with especially with television and
nowadays,
the revenue that's
right,
put into it.
Is,
you know, what are you generating for me if I'm going to put money into it as a TV network? But it certainly doesn't take away from the passion and achievements of women. And when you do think about 30, 40 years ago where women's sports was.
Before, you know, Title IX. Well,
yeah, before Title IX, and yeah, really was the big impetus of the growth in women's sports. And take a person like Katie Smith, you know, here from Logan, Ohio, and the things that she did at Ohio State and internationally in basketball. And she has talked about she never would have had those opportunities if not for the trailblazers that led the way before her.
Mitchie Collette, what got you into football?
Well, I was always an athlete. I was probably I was the only athlete in my family, and I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, I couldn't really play a lot of sports because my father was in the military. And to make a long story short, by the time I was 14, I had been in 26 states. So we never really had time to play sports. When we moved to Toledo, that's when I started high school, and they had sports. I didn't know anything about Title IX. No clue. I just knew that there was basketball and track, and I got to play. And then my junior year, I found out about the Toledo Troopers. And I was a shot putter in track, and I asked my coach, I said, should I go to the Olympics as a shot putter? Because I was pretty decent back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Or should I play football? And he point blank looked at me and says, just play football. So that kind of told me, you know, I better just play football. So I ended up joining the Toledo Troopers, and there I am.
But you didn't have a background in football.
No, not at all. I never touched a football in my life.
Until then. What was it like being in a sport as a woman that is dominated to this day by men?
Wow, that is a very good question. I look back and I think, you know, when we played for the Troopers, that stadium was full. There were times that it was standing room only. And nowadays that women are in so many different sports that, you know, it's like it's the norm. Okay, it used to be that it was just men's soccer. Now it's women's soccer. Mm-hmm. It used to be, you know, they had pro softball, all this kind of stuff. And now I think it's just becoming so much of the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Than it was back in the day.
At least back in the day, you had the benefit of being a curiosity, if nothing else.
Yeah. And that, you know, just like back in the day, the guys are making hand over fist money because this is a new thing out there, and they want to see women hit. So, you know, it's just the thing that, you know, back then it was way curious, and now it's like, well, it's another sport for women, and they're going to go out there and they're going to, you know, play soccer or baseball or softball or even volleyball or football now.
Todd Jones, I mean, there are other examples of women in sports that stand out in Ohio, right?
Oh, yeah. You go back to even like in the 50s, Shirley Fry from Akron was the best women's tennis player in the world. And so that's another example of a name that, you know, in her day, she got a little bit of attention, but she gets lost over time. Mm-hmm. So you think about that. Think about Stephanie Hightower, the great track and field athlete from Ohio State who went on to Olympic success. And not only that, but what she did for women's sports and her administrative roles. So, yeah, there's plenty of names and achievements that go deep into the state of Ohio.
But there were struggles, too, I mean, along the way.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, again, up until Title IX, the federal legislation in the early 70s, I mean, you had women's sports like in the 50s where they wouldn't allow the women to run full court in basketball. They had six members on a team on the court. Three would stay on one end and three would stay on the other because they didn't think it was like ladylike to play, to run up and down the court. So think about how far you've come and how ridiculous that was at the time.
Well, I just think about what Mitchie said earlier about, you know, the first lady of the country calling off women's football because it was exploitative.
Yeah, right, right. And that's the thing. Women always had to fight, you know, the stereotypes that come in to gender and role playing in terms of what you're doing in athletics. So they've had had to deal with a lot more than men have had to deal with when it comes to that in sports.
Except unless we get into the race issue, which is a whole other story. Mitchie Collette, any pushback along the way in your career in football? And now, do people ever give you a hard time, or did they ever?
The only ones that really gave me a hard time was when I was in the military and I had a game that weekend, and my commander is like, really? You really have to go? Come on, is this for football again? You know, because I was in the military playing football then, you know, for Toledo back then.
Uh-huh.
He's the only one that gave me a hard time, but I think he was probably one of my biggest fans.
No, so no one ever gave, it wasn't no negative things. Well, I want to say thank you to Mitchie Collette. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor.
You bet. Mitchie Collette, coach, co-owner, and co-founder of the Toledo Rain football team. She played 7 years for the now-defunct Toledo Troopers. It was recognized by the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton as the winningest team in professional football
history. Think about that, how awesome that is.
I mean, it's amazing. Right. Absolutely amazing. And that was Mitchie Collette. Still with us, Todd Jones, a former longtime Dispatch sports reporter and columnist, and now Ohio State Alumni Magazine sports writer. By the way, I'm moderating a discussion tonight about the importance of sports to our culture with Dr. Pete Edwards, co-owner of the Columbus Crew, and Gene Smith, Ohio State's Director of Athletics. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back with more stories, maybe some more of the hidden stories, the ones you don't know about sports in Ohio. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about Ohio's role in the history of American sports, the topic of an extensive new exhibit at the Ohio History Connection. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Still with us is Ohio State Alumni Magazine sports writer, longtime Dispatch sports reporter and columnist, Todd Jones. George W. Morton, was the head swimming coach at Cleveland State University when John McClendon was hired. McClendon is recognized as the first African-American basketball coach at a predominantly white university and the first African-American head coach in any professional sport. And we have George Morton here to talk about it. You go by Wally. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ann. I really appreciate being part of the discussion.
You were a swim coach. John McClendon was a basketball coach, but I understand that you worked closely together.
Yes, we did. Actually, the reason you're talking to me is because of John McClendon's greatness. And when you were around John, you understood that you were around greatness, and you were also around a person that would make you better because of his presence. And John was more than just a basketball coach. He actually taught swimming at Cleveland State and loved swimming. He also was a gymnast when he was younger, but his primary love and what he's recognized for is basketball for many reasons. And yes, I was good friends with John, and he was a big influence on my life.
What kind of influence was he on the school, given the fact that he was the first on those two scores?
Yes, well, he was a huge influence because he was more than just sport. His greatest accomplishment is he was a person that advanced civil rights. I think he is an iconic person in terms of the advancement of civil rights. And the way he advanced civil rights is he brought people together. And when you were around him, he made you the most important part of that relationship. And in his case, with swimming, he knew everything about swimming. He knew the greatest swimming coaches. He knew the most advanced technique in swimming. So he was a true intellect, and he was an influence on all parts of Cleveland State University. And later in life, he became basically an advisor and a counselor to all of the coaches.
You know, Ty Jones, Coach McClendon was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame just 3 years ago. We still have a ways to go when it comes. I mean, this is such a prominent person in the business.
Yeah, terrible oversight, right? All these years and the impact that he had.
Right in our backyard.
And that's where I really hope that this exhibit that the Ohio History Connection will help do, is to help shed the light on some of the forgotten stories that should not have been forgotten, and recognize some of the people who were groundbreakers and people who set standards and people who went against the grain for the good of either their gender or their race. And their stories, unfortunately, get lost in the shuffle because we're focused so much on especially the present. I do think the exhibit, that if people go, they will jar the memories and hopefully get the stories out there that people should be recognized and not just lost in history.
Wally Morton was,
yes.
Was John McClendon, was he an activist in the civil rights movement?
You know, he was an activist in his own way quite revered by everybody. But I just wanted you, could I just tell you a brief story about him? Okay, so his mother was a Delaware Indian, a Native American. His father was African American. He ended up in Kansas. He loved the sport of basketball. He wanted to go to Springfield College, where basketball was invented, and his father said to him, "Well, Naismith is at the University of Kansas. He's the athletic director." So he goes to Kansas. This is in the early 1930s. And he walks into James Naismith's office, the inventor of basketball, and he says, "I would like you to be my advisor." And he said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Because my father told me you're to be my advisor." So then he became good friends with Naismith. But what was interesting is he loved swimming, so he would go to the swimming pool and swim at the University of Kansas at a time when there was great, great racial divide. And after he swam, they would drain the pool and refill it.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was a very, very, tough time to be black or African-American. But yet he never let that get in his way of building people up, everybody around him. And, of course, he went on to be the inventor of the fast break, the full court press, the four-corner offense.
Wow.
He was one of, with his teams, he basically wanted them to shoot the ball every 8 seconds. So he was the inventor of modern-day basketball in many respects, but that's really not, that's minor compared to what else he did. He, and I'm sure you have this, Todd, maybe in your exhibit, but he organized the first basketball game that was interracial. And at the time when he first started coaching, and he was in Georgia at a traditional historical black institution, he organized a game, and this was during World War II, against Duke University. And his team was kind of lopsided, and it was organized at a time where no fans could, because of Jim Crow, no fans could attend. Mm. It was a private thing, but he wanted to promote integration. And when it appeared his team was, with this fast break form of basketball, was kind of pummeling Duke, he went to the coach and he said, "Why don't we just mix the teams? Let's have, the blacks and whites, on each side." And there's been, books written about this. It's called The Secret Game.
He did this to make it fair. He wanted to make it fair.
He wanted to make it fair, yeah. And he also, the reason for the game was to promote racial harmony.
Hmm.
And so they've done a film on that. ESPN has. Mm. And there have been books written about this. So he is probably one of the greatest coaches in American history that nobody's probably, not many people have heard of.
Had you heard of him, Todd Jones?
Yeah, but not nearly to this depth, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and again, that's, think about that. That's, you know, that's
30
that's
years covering sports in Ohio.
And it's just somebody like that is not getting the attention, even from a person who used to be in the media like
now,
myself.
I know. Now I want to go look up that ESPN film about it. Now I want to take a quick call here from Doug in Columbus. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hey, Ann. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, it's a really great topic. I don't know if you guys have talked about Jim Klein, the founding of NFL in Columbus.
You know what, Doug? For some reason, I can't hear you very well. Where it's modulating badly. Could you hold the phone away from your mouth?
Yeah. Oh. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I just wondered if you'd spoken yet about Joe Klein, the founding of the NFL, or the Nesser brothers played for the Columbus Panhandles. Chris Willis has written a couple of really terrific books.
The Nesser brothers.
Both these guys.
They called them the Columbus Panhandlers?
Yeah, the Panhandles. They worked at the Panhandle Station for the Pennsylvania Railroad over near Woodland Park on the east side. As a fact, in 1921, Ted Nesser and his son played on the same team. So if you go to the NFL, you know, Hall of Fame, you'll see that in 21, it's the first and only time they know of an intergenerational father-son playing on the same team.
That's interesting. Had you heard of them, Todd Jones?
Yeah, you had John, Al, Ted, Phil, Fred, and Frank.
They're in the exhibit.
And they, they were pretty much what the team was known for. They didn't win many games. I think they only won, like, three games, but the NFL offices were here in Columbus.
Right, I've heard about
that. And people
that.
Don't even realize that. It's right in downtown, across from the State House, on the corner of High and Broad. The building there was where the NFL had its offices. Joe Carr was the commissioner.
That gets me thinking about what if it still was.
Well, I think about the trajectory of the city if they had stayed with the NFL in that regard. So it's an interesting topic in that way. You also had like the Portsmouth Spartans played for the NFL championship against the Chicago Bears. And the stadium that Portsmouth played in still sits down on the river in Portsmouth. It's an old stone, looks like a glorified high school stadium. But the Panhandlers won a game there that sent them into an NFL championship game played in Chicago against the mighty Bears.
Doug, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. You know, Wally Morton, just getting back to John McClendon for a minute here, the first black basketball coach at Cleveland State University. Was there a culture at Cleveland State that enabled the management there, the people who ran the place, to do this at that time?
I honestly don't think that it was based on culture. I think it was based on his qualifications.
Who's the best, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of people would say, well, Cleveland State is, you know, maybe perhaps a high percentage of African Americans attend the university, but at the time he was hired, there was probably 6% of the students were African American. So it was a predominantly white institution, and he was hired because of his background with the ABA team called the Cleveland Pipers, and the Cleveland Pipers then ultimately became the Cleveland Cavaliers. But he was the first African-American coach hired in professional basketball, and he was hired by George Steinbrenner, who owned the team. So he has an amazing history. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And interestingly enough, he really evolved from the basketball coach to ultimately being on the faculty at Cleveland State. And he was a teacher, and even when he was a coach, he was a teacher.
What did he teach?
Well, he basically taught in sport management and in physical education and sport.
Todd Jones, I wanted to ask you if there was anything that surprised you after all your years of covering sports in Ohio that really caught your eye in this exhibit and that made you curious and want to know more.
Well, I think it maybe not so much surprised me, but it reinforced the idea that that Ohio isn't just football. As grand as our tradition is with football, especially obviously with Ohio State and the Cleveland Browns and the Bengals, but there's so many athletes and so many coaches in different sports that sports has always been important in general to the state. And so we get so tied into our reputation being a football state, which it is, and we have so much glory with that. But, you know, we have Jack Nicklaus, the greatest golfer ever, right? Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, some baseball players. We have Pete Rose set the all-time hits record. We have just different – we have great Olympians, you know, Dave Waddell, different people who've won great gold medals. And I think sometimes football, just like I said, when the coasts take all the attention away from the Midwest in sports, sometimes even in our own state, we kind of forget the fact that besides all the great football tradition, not to take away from that, but besides that, we've had so many athletes and coaches in so many different sports.
Hmm. Including swimming and diving, where my former swimmer Bill Dorencott is the head coach at the Ohio State, and they've won 10 NCAA titles there, and probably have more All-Americans in swimming and diving than any other school in the United States. So there's great tradition across in all of the sports, and I think it's a wonderful exhibit you're doing, and I'm going to definitely attend. But could I just say one more thing about before the program ends about Tom McClendon? You know, the highest award in athletics is presented in his name at Cleveland State, and it's not for just athletic accomplishment. It's for education and for community service. And the first swimmer we had that received that was South Africa, and he came from an apartheid country. And he came from the center of apartheid, the city he was from. Mm-hmm. And yet he was presented this great award named in John McClendon, but one of his roommates was African-American. And because he was so influenced by John McClendon, he went back to South Africa, and he got married, and he made his best man in his wedding. And by the way, this was Jim Crow on steroids in South Africa at the time.
Right.
And he made his best man that African American roommate that he had at Cleveland State. So this is what sport can do. Sport can literally change society. And John McClendon is a great example of that. But in the sport of basketball, just his invention of fast break basketball speaks for itself.
I can't even imagine some of the things you mentioned that he developed as a coach. You just take for granted that that's always been that way, or that it happened more organically and that there wasn't one person responsible for it. Right, Ted?
Yeah, it even happens in the NFL with Paul Brown, you know.
Yeah, yep.
Our sense of history with the NFL kind of goes back to the beginning of ESPN.
Yeah.
And so you never hear the greatest coaches ever. People don't even talk about Paul Brown. He practically invented all the things that a majority of things that we take for granted.
Modern day football.
Right.
And you never hear him mentioned anymore. It just kind of goes back to, Bill Parcells and Belichick and these guys. And again, hopefully this type of exhibit will remind people that there's so many things that Ohio's contributed in so many ways to the world of sports.
Todd Jones, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, too.
Todd Jones, former Dispatch sports reporter and columnist, now Ohio State Alumni Magazine sports writer. And Wally Morton, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Anytime I can talk about John McClendon, it's a great day.
That's George W. Morton, was the head swimming coach at Cleveland State University when John McClendon was hired. McClendon is recognized as the first African-American basketball coach at a predominantly white university and the first African-American head coach in any professional sport. I want to remind folks I'm moderating a discussion tonight about the importance of sports to our culture with Dr. Pete Edwards, co-owner of the Columbus Crew, and Gene Smith, Ohio State University's Director of Athletics. For more information, check out the link on the website at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Want to say thanks to the All Sides staff. That includes producer Mary Lee Williams and assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, our All Sides interns, Maisie Glockner, Sophie Warner, and Ray Brewster, who produced this show, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DiCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me too. I'm at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.